Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Writing for the pages of the New York Times, Joe Biden says he does not want a NATO-Russia war. In the same article, he was unclear how the conflict in Ukraine should end. Negotiations do not appear to be a high priority. In the meantime, the EU agreed to a sixth round of sanctions. All the while, Ukraine is losing on the battlefield. Crosstalking the threat of escalation, I'm joined by my guest, Charles Ortel, in New York. He's an invested writer as well as host of Sunday with Charles podcast. In North Florida, we have Tom Luongo. He is publisher of Gold, Goats, and Guns blog and newsletter. And in Paris, we cross to Pepe Escobar. He's an independent geopolitical analyst and author specializing in Eurasia. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Pepe, let me go to you first. I mentioned the president of the United States in my introduction. What I gleaned from it, it didn't make a whole lot of sense to me. I don't know who wrote it for him. It looked like a group of low octane lawyers that wrote it, because very legalistic. It was very legalistic. Right? But he said here, or at least the article, we are not encouraging or enabling Ukraine to strike beyond its borders. We do not want to prolong the war just to inflict pain on Russia. But everything this administration has done, and everything the European Union has done, and NATO, is exactly what he said he wants to avoid. Pepe.
Well, first of all, there is no president of the United States. We have what I call crash test dummy. We have an earpiece, a teleprompter, and a combo behind him issuing orders that he may or may not be able to read, and certainly not able to interpret what he's reading. Don't forget that until this New York Times op-ed piece, the main idea was an infinite war, like a replay of the 1980s jihad in Afghanistan, but now with neo-Nazi mercenaries or neo-Nazis already encrusted in the Kiev system, lasting years, if not decades, to boggle down Russia and, in the words of Lloyd Raytheon Austin, weaken it. And now, no, not anymore. We want a stalemate and diplomacy, which was exactly what they were having, diplomacy, until a few weeks ago in Istanbul. When I was in Istanbul a few weeks ago, that famous meeting organized by Erdogan, even Sergei Lavrov was saying, oops, now we have some agreement with the Ukrainians, so, you know, let's get the ball rolling. The next day, it was end of any diplomacy. So now it's back to diplomacy and a stalemate. You cannot have a stalemate when you're losing badly, as you mentioned in your introduction.
Yes.
And in Donbass, this is going to happen maybe until the end of this month of June. It will be over in Donbass, or max mid-July. So diplomacy would be a desperate measure from an administration that is being contested inside the U.S., according to our latest information, by the real masters of the universe. The guys who really pull the levers, East Coast aristocracy and some silos inside the deep state, they are not part of the neocon humanitarian imperialist combo. So obviously this administration knows they are on a bind, knows that they are going to lose badly in the midterms. They are desperate because most Americans now, they are saying you're a bunch of incompetent fools. Inflation, a gallon of gas in California for $8, you know.
Yeah,
where are we going next?
The interesting thing for me, if I go to Charles here right now, is that you know as well as I do, very rarely is foreign policy on the agenda in any election. Okay, it's sometimes a bit very, very rarely. And if the Biden administration thinks they can use Ukraine and democracy in Ukraine, they're fools. Okay, because if at the same time you have this problem with baby formula and then up to $53 billion being sent to Ukraine, when it's obvious when Ukrainian officials themselves admit they are doing very badly on the battlefield. Go ahead, Charles.
Yeah, I mean, this is an administration 17 months in that has proven beyond doubt that it is led by fools,
yeah,
barely led by fools, at every important post in the executive branch of government. Then you turn over to the legislative branch. That's a disaster. They've politicized the courts. And the people who are doing well out of all this, as you say, are the people behind the scenes who profit from volatility, people like George Soros, other sophisticated investors, the people they pay off, who get paid off as a result of their activities. The people who are really in horrific shape are in the inner cities. The very constituents that the left, the progressives claim to represent, are the ones who are being butchered in the streets with savage violence, who are out of hope of paying, you know, for their daily cost of living, given this raging inflation. And it's not just 8%. It's a lot higher than that.
Yep.
Our educational system is succeeding in turning kids who ought to have hope for the future into wokesters who have little clue of understanding what's really going on in the world. They're mere pawns in this effort to, I think, destroy what we know, what we used to know as the United States of America. And who benefits from all this? I don't think Russia benefits from all this. I suspect it's China. And are we going to have a serious inquiry into how China has paid off the Biden family and other leading politicians, including Mitch McConnell? Are we ever going to have a serious investigation of that?
Well, I mean, Charles, maybe on the upside is what it took like 15 months for them to recognize that the Hunter Biden laptop was real. So maybe there is hope here somewhere. OK, let me go to Tom. Tom, you know, all this bluster that's going on. Putin must not win. Ukraine must not lose. I mean, that is not a very articulate way of looking at geopolitics. OK, because really what they end up looking like a group of clowns. And it's already been pointed out they are. And we can go all, you know, Liz Truss, you know, Bojo. I mean, we don't even have to count Joe Biden, Blinken, Victoria Nuland. For the last two, this is unfinished business. But that's not good for the country. It's not good for Europe. It's not good for Ukraine. And it's certainly not good for Russia. Go ahead, Tom.
No, it's not good for anybody, actually. And this is the thing that I think everybody needs to wrap their head around. The Biden administration aren't incompetent. They know exactly what they're doing. They're vandals. And they're not letting any crisis go to waste. I think this is a very dangerous situation that we have, where we have I agree with Pepe, we don't have a president-elect. He was selected to destroy the United States. I also agree with Charles on this point as well. And once we start to wrap our head around the idea that that's what's going on here, then all of their policy makes sense. Like the destruction of the middle class in Europe and the United States are clear here. The idea that we are going to fight Russia in a proxy war in Ukraine is being done in order to, in the long run, to undermine the idea that the American military can actually fight a real war, right? There's a much deeper, I think, agenda happening here that is, I think, very, very, very dangerous, which is the wholesale undermining of the legitimacy of the United States as any kind of political, rational political or geopolitical actor. And, you know, and the Brits are happily, you know, pushing us along into this this nightmare. And it's crazy to watch it play out. And the sad truth is that by doing this, we picked this war in Ukraine, and now we're angry with the Russians with the way that they're prosecuting it, which is to not have given Ukraine the war that we prepped them for, which was an air war, and they're just doing an artillery trench war.
Yeah, but Tom,
we're angry with them about
it. It's really interesting that, you know, I hear all of the, you know, the quote unquote smart people, the grown-ups, you know, talk about how this can be settled. But those ideas were before the conflict started, and the West was completely indifferent to it. Okay, Pepe, you know, one of the there's this issue of escalation here, and I remember very clearly. So do you. I did programs all through December, January, and February on it, is what the Russians said that they were willing to do if they weren't listened to. And now they're saying it again about these new missile systems. I mean, are they so tone deaf in Washington and London? Because this is where this is coming from. You know, a warning has come and they're pretending. No, it's not real. He's bluffing. This is dangerous behavior, Pepe.
It is extremely dangerous, and their inability to. Okay, they never read Claude Lévi-Strauss, but that would be too highbrow for these people. But at least trying to understand the other, very, very simple terms, philosophical terms, they can't. They are completely insulated. They live in a bubble. And dialogue in terms of international relations and diplomacy is dead.
Yeah.
Sanctions, by definition, are a hysterical reaction for a political problem. They don't qualify as diplomacy at all, and not even as a means of pressure. Look at sanctions did with Cuba and Iran. Cuba and Iran learn how to live with sanctions, just like Russia learned how to live with sanctions for the past 8 years. I think something that for our American audience, you know, my interlocutors, yourself, everybody else's, you have no idea if you are in the States, how much worse is the non-dialogue situation here in Europe.
Yeah.
I've never seen anything like that in my lifetime. I've lived in at least five different European nations for the past 40, 50 years, since I was a teenager, in fact. And if you want to have a high-level conversation about the NATO-Russia war and the influence of the United States on what's happening in Ukraine with academics and so-called strategic analysts here in France, in Italy, and in Germany, it's absolutely, absolutely
Pepe,
impossible.
Let me jump in here. Let me go to Charles before we go to the break here. Pepe brings up a really interesting point, because if you dissent from the normative narrative, you are really, really gone after. I mean, 17 years of my work was deleted on YouTube, okay? They are terrified of information, not disinformation. Go ahead before we go to the break.
Sure. I mean, and it's more than a little bit ironic. In America, the people who are leading this charge cut their teeth in the 60s. Many of them were hippies begging for the mainstream, the establishment, to give them a chance to have their ideas heard. They get in power. What do? They crush anybody who might criticize them, with the Disinformation Governance Board being one attempt. And I suspect that attempt began long before Nina Jankowicz got involved and is continuing during this broadcast and will accelerate after it.
Yes, and I want to reiterate, they're not going out, they're not fighting disinformation, misinformation. They don't want people to speak truth to power. That's what this is all about here. All right, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on the threat of escalation. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing the threat of escalation. Okay, let's go back to Tom. Tom, one of the things that I find very, very peculiar during all of this is that we all know in this program that the middle class and working class people over the last 40 years have been just bludgeoned, I mean, terribly so, by this neoliberal ideology, where it is a uniparty that benefits from it. But, you know, this is destroying working people and their hopes for the future on steroids right now, because as Pepe and I have talked about earlier, you know, inflation is something that, you know, was somebody else's problem. It was in the global south. It was these people that don't know how to run things. And now we're seeing it galloping. And that is very, very serious for working people all across the Western world. You have to use your car. You need energy. And that is being sacrificed right now. They're creating social tensions that I don't think they have a clue on how to handle. Go ahead, Tom.
No, I would agree with you completely, Peter. Actually, I've been writing about this for a long time, saying that I believe what I call Davos, right? I really do believe that we're dealing with that kind of intellectually bankrupt class of oligarchs that just met at Davos are the ones driving so much of this. And they really do believe that they have to tear the world down in order to rebuild it. And, you know, every good communist takeover starts with a toilet paper shortage, right? So they're doing this all across the West, especially in Europe, and to a lesser extent in the United States. I believe that it's going to be able to take hold because we still have some vestiges of a decentralized governmental system here. We still have places like where I live in Florida, where we have a strong state government that can resist the federal government. But it is gutting to everybody across the middle class, but this is their goal. This is their stated goal. They've made no bones about it, so they're just running their script point.
Tom,
it's very scary.
It is very scary here. And has anybody checked? Maybe I missed something, but has anybody checked in Europe and in the United States that they want to see their lifestyle and standard of living to decrease because of Ukraine? Has anybody been asked that? Pepe, why don't you answer that? Is it worth it? Is the sacrifice? Because the sacrifices are being made by poor people, including Ukrainians, including Russians, including the global South.
You're absolutely right, Peter. And this is something that it's a kind of conversation that along these lines you can have it in a cafe here in Paris. Who's issuing the orders? And everybody more or less knows that they're not the capitals of Europe and national governments. It's the European Commission in Brussels via Führer Ursula von der Leyen, as I call him, from Lügenpresse in German. She's not von der Leyen. And granddaddy was, or Ursula granddaddy was a Nazi von der Leyen. So this is very, very serious because in terms of real non-democracy, they are one step ahead already. And the average citizen in, not so much in Germany, but I would say here in Italy, in Spain, and Greece, they know exactly what's going on. And it's all about Brussels, Charles Michel, this Eurocrat junta, unelected people, completely disconnected from real life, and especially real life by average European citizens. I'm not even talking about Eastern Europe, which from the point of view of London, Paris, and Rome is in the middle of nowhere. I'm talking about Paris, about Geneva, about Milano, about Rome, about Barcelona, where people are feeling the pinch, and they know that who is taking these decisions to fight till the last neo-Nazi Ukrainian over there, and you have to turn off a hot water and freeze in winter so you can defend democracy. This comes straight from Brussels.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the I don't refer to him as Chancellor Schultz. I refer to him as Sergeant Schultz on this program, okay? Because that's essentially what he is. He takes orders, okay? I mean, you know, if you look at the entire lineage of chancellors since the Second World War, this is an embarrassment, okay? A real embarrassment. Charles, the Nazis have been mentioned a couple of times here on this program, and I really think it's important to talk more about it. The Department of Homeland Security is, quote-unquote, concerned over Nazis returning to the U.S. after fighting in Ukraine. Well, I mean, why are we sending money to Ukraine if it's, there are Nazis there? I mean, this is completely inexplicable to me here. And I have to give a call out to the Gray Zone. They've had some wonderful articles on here. But, you know, it's in plain sight if you want to know something about this. But no, it's not. It's another example of always siding with the worst elements of another country. Go ahead, Charles.
Yeah, it's disgraceful. I mean, you don't even need to bring up the open southern border. If we're so concerned about people streaming back, maybe we should close our southern border at a tenth the cost of sending all the money over to Ukraine. Beyond that, though, I think in the United States, I went to decent schools, and we never really studied back in the 70s and 80s, at least I didn't, the Ukraine or the constituent elements of the Soviet states. And we certainly don't have a clear education over here, in my view, as to what really happened to cause the end of World War II in Europe, which nation bore the heaviest price, and I think it was the former Soviet Union in terms of dead and gravely injured and economic damage and all that. And why now, 75 years or 77 years later, why does the United States still need to have all these military bases in Western Europe, which do pose threats to Russia, in states that are very rich now? I mean, why are we doing this? Why does it make sense for America's sons and daughters to put our lives at risk in these flashpoints 77 years later? Is this going to be the case 770 years from now?
Well, Charles, for me, it's just a grift. It's just a grift, okay? It is to, you know, keep NATO employed with nice budgets. I mean, NATO is really a propaganda operation. It's not even a military alliance. I mean, it's the United States. The French can throw a little bit in. The British can throw a little bit in. And Turkey, and nobody trusts the Turks, okay? The rest of it is a propaganda machine, okay? And that's what's really difficult to explain to the public here, because we're, you know, there's a military conflict going on in Ukraine, and in Western Europe, as they destroy their own lifestyle and economies, it's a propaganda war. This is asymmetrical in every single way. You know, Tom, you know, one of the things, one of the most important issues that is always discussed here is energy, energy, and energy, okay? And right. The Europeans are doing everything they can to get away from Russian energy, which is fine with the Russians because the rest of the world wants it. These people are foolish, okay? But the caveat is, Europe's great friend, America, is going to cash in on it, okay? That's what America does to its friends, okay? Its NATO allies, okay? Destroy their economy and make sure that they're not competitive. And the way I look at it is having hegemony over Europe, well, it's a Pyrrhic victory for the U.S. because it's a worthless asset at the end of the day. Go ahead, Tom.
Well, it's funny. You saw the I just saw some recent headlines to this effect that that we're shipping, we're exporting more oil and more natural gas to Europe than we have before, and we're looking ever have before. And prices here in the United States are off the charts. So all that's happening here is that we're seeing, you know, everybody suffer. Like, it's not just Europe. Europe is getting more expensive energy from the United States, and Americans domestically are paying more for energy because the marginal flows that would normally go to fill our refineries and fill our pipelines aren't there. They're all going getting exported by a Cheniere's, you know, LNG terminal down in Louisiana and shipped over to Finland and Germany and the rest and Poland. And it's insane. So everybody's losing here, Peter. And again, I reiterate this point. This is done on purpose. The goal is clear from these people. They want to take the world off of hydrocarbons, and they think that at the same time they can then also split Russia off from OPEC, because they believe that the Arab states are so dumb as to not realize that these people are hostile to hydrocarbons, and that, you know, they'll gladly take up the slack of the market share. Like, you can see it. OPEC is refusing to back down here and even take Biden's phone calls. And I watched this play out, and I'm like, I mean, I know you guys are vandals, but at least could you be competent at it? I mean, I can do this better. I'm not that I would, but I mean, they're not just vandals. They're incompetent. I guess they're incompetent vandals. It's even worse.
Well, I mean,
it's unbelievable.
But Tom, let me go to Pepe right now. At the end of the day, they believe that, you know, they know every decision they make doesn't affect them personally. Okay. I mean, all these people making the decisions in Europe, in the U.S., do you think they even know what a liter of gasoline costs? I doubt it, you know? I mean, when's the last time they've been in a grocery store? Their food is all brought to them. I mean, that they have no idea of really what they're doing, and it's all ideology. I agree with what Tom is saying. This is intentional, but it's being done intentionally by incompetence. Go ahead, Pepe.
Yes, incompetence and also by design. Tom raised a very important point. It is by design. And implemented by beyond incompetence. So it's absolutely appalling in terms of non-leadership politically and geoeconomically. They don't understand geoeconomics at all. They don't understand Eurasia, none of it. If you have a conversation with people behind these governments in England, here, in Germany, and in Italy as well, my academic friends who know about Eurasia, who travel back and forth, they say they have absolutely no clue what's really going on in Russia, China, India, Kazakhstan, Pakistan, Turkey, Iran, etc. And there are some this is one of the things that I do in my job. I track these movements. It slowly but surely, they're getting their act together. For instance, try to explain in Brussels that the Eurasia Economic Union is working on an alternative monetary economic system. They have no clue about that. Try to explain to them that India and Russia and Iran are trading more and more bilaterally within their own currencies, and they are planning to interact their payment systems as well. For instance, the Russians are going to do this with the Iranians. They couldn't do it yet with the Chinese because UnionPay is afraid of American sanctions.
Yep.
So, and Chinese banks are absolutely desperate of being caught in the sanctions maze. But trying to have this conversation here at high levels of power with the national governments in Europe is absolutely impossible because they are also hostages of Brussels.
Yes, but Pepe, they also think that the world still revolves around them. That's what's really extraordinary. I mean, things are rapidly changing so fast, and they still think that they're at the center of everything, that everybody's thinking about them. No, they're becoming irrelevant because they're making themselves irrelevant, and they're certainly not serious people. That's why the Global South, you want to fight over Ukraine? Fine. We don't want to get involved. You made that problem. You fix it. That's their attitude. All right, gentlemen, this was a wonderful, pleasurable conversation, but we've run out of time. I want to thank my guests in New York, Florida, and in Paris. I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk Rules.